Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Wren Women Salon Podcast, a series of interviews about what it is to be a modern-day Renaissance woman and how to flourish as a Wren woman in today's world. I'm your host, Dale Griffith Stamos, co-author of Wren Women, What Modern Renaissance Women Have to Teach Us About Living Rich, Fulfilling Lives. This is your host, Dale Griffith Stamos, and welcome to our Wren Women Among Us podcast, a series featuring incredible modern-day Renaissance women. This series, along with our Meet the Wren Women series, which features women who were profiled in our book, Wren Women, will introduce you to some fascinating women. Now, people often ask, what is a Wren woman? And the short answer is, a Wren woman is someone past or present who is a multifaceted Renaissance-style woman who brings to the world a unique perspective and expansive attitude. She is not only about achievement, but about service and embracing a meaningful life. Now, today, I am very pleased to welcome Molly Ann Lakin to the program. Now, Molly Ann Lakin is an Emmy-nominated songwriter, author, columnist, speechwriter, and songwriting coach. She has written songs which have been performed by hundreds of recording artists, including Anne Murray, Cher, Tina Turner, and Placido Domingo. Molly has written themes and songs for over five dozen TV shows and movies, including the song Violet, which won an Oscar. She is the author of 8 nonfiction books, including How to Write a Hit Song and How to Be a Hit Songwriter, and her columns on songwriting have been syndicated internationally for the past 20 years. She coaches developing writers and artists all over the world. 12 of them are Grammy winners, 15 more are Grammy nominees, and with her help, 7,470 other writers and artists have placed their tracks in movies, TV shows, on CDs, in video games, and commercials, and their work is downloaded all over the web. My, as if that weren't enough, Molly also writes speeches for CEOs, CFOs, and, she adds, UFOs. Plus, she makes a world-class sour cream, cinnamon, raisin, coffee cake, nuts optional. You can reach her at songmd.com and anythingwithwords.com. Now, Molly represents the Wren Women traits of growth and expansion, creativity, trust in one's dreams, and the desire to inspire others. Welcome, Molly.
Thank you, Dale. How lovely to be with you this morning.
Well, we're just thrilled to have you. And, you know, what's nice about this program is that we've had women from all walks of life, from all different career paths, and it's so much fun to have you on. I think you're our first person who's in the songwriting business, and my goodness, have you flourished in that business. I am incredibly impressed that when I'm quoting the 7,400, I'm going, how in the world did you find time to help all those others, which, you know, we'll get into. Now, the podcast is called Wren Women Among Us because since I worked on the book, I've been discovering more and more Renaissance-style women, and I've wanted to really pick their brains. So, my first question is, starting at the beginning, what was your childhood and adolescence like? Who were your parents? What did they do? And what were some difficulties you faced? And what really were your inner imperatives, even as a young person?
I was always singing as a child. I remember when I was, well, just old enough to remember, every Sunday, my parents took my brother and me to a restaurant called Café Champlain. We lived in Ottawa, Canada, and Café Champlain was in the middle of the Ottawa River that bridged the provinces of Ontario and Quebec. And Café Champlain had a jukebox. I'd never seen anything like this. And you could just go, Daddy would give you a nickel, and you could just go and push a button. And I knew all the songs. In fact, I used to stand on the table and sing. And everybody used to sing along with me and think, oh, isn't that cute, that chubby little redhead is singing again. And Cruising Down the River was one of my favorites. I don't know if it was ever a hit, but it was on that jukebox. So that was me. I was always singing, glued to the radio. My parents had lots of friends who would come over on Saturday nights. We had a big room at the back of our house that was paneled in knotty pine, and there were thousands of books in there and a piano. And Mrs. Bloomfield from up the street used to play the piano, and she played Cole Porter and all the show tunes. And I used to sit at the top of the stairs and sing along with them. I was supposed to be asleep, but I want to ask you, how am I supposed to sleep with that racket going on? So I sang along with them, and finally when I was 9 years old, my mother sent me to Rita Gregory to take piano lessons, and I was good. And I took lessons for 2 years and really loved it, even the theory, which can put most people to sleep. But then I started changing the endings of Rondo and all those other pieces they give you to learn. And my mother was really upset. How dare you tamper with Mozart? So she locked the piano. Oh, and so then I started playing pop songs, and that was it. She didn't want that noise in her house. She locked the piano, and I still was addicted to the radio and used to listen to the northern New York State radio stations, especially Buffalo, WKBW. And they had all the hit songs before we did in Canada. It's like we were in the third world. So I knew all of those songs and tried to play them on the keyboard, on the piano, but my mother wouldn't hear of it. So then I went to the University of Toronto and was living in a dorm called Whitney Hall, and somebody down the hall had a baritone ukulele, which she taught me to play. And for my entire freshman year, that's all I did. So,
you know what? Yeah, go ahead. I was going to say, I love this story because it has some resonances with my own. I came out of the womb singing, and I was, up until the age of 13, I was training in classical music, and I wanted to move to pop music. And it was my piano teacher who refused to go on with me because I wanted to do pop music, so I related to that. But go ahead, please continue.
So there I was, a ukulele player with a degree in French literature, whoop-de-doo. And in those days, I had three choices. I could marry a nice Jewish dentist, I could be a teacher, or I could be a nurse. Well, I guess I could have been a secretary, too. But let me tell you that when I looked for jobs and they asked for my typing speed, which actually was in the hundreds, I never told them, I didn't even put on my resume that I could type.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, I just wasn't interested in jobs. I'd get them okay, but then 6 weeks later I'd quit because I need to go home and write songs. Anyway, when I graduated from college and went back to my parents' house, I sat in the garden for the entire summer and played my ukulele, and my father came out and said, "Do you mean to tell me that I sent you to college and you're going to sit here in my garden and make that racket for the rest of your life?" And I said, "Yeah, that's pretty much it." So they sent me off to Israel for me to learn the value of hard work. And when I got to Israel, there was a group of 40 of us that was like the Peace Corps, only it was 1 year. And we happened to be in a town smack on the Mediterranean called Ashkelon. And in the mornings, we learned Hebrew, and in the afternoons, we all walked down to the beach, where, guess what? I played my ukulele. And on the way to Israel, I need to tell you that I had a one-night stopover in New York City and, of course, made a beeline for Greenwich Village. And everybody in Greenwich Village had guitars. They were singing Blowin' in the Wind. They were wearing jean jackets and torn shoes. And here am I in my little Canadian dress with a white Peter Pan collar and these pumps. Remember those little pumps we used to wear? Anyway, my parents had given me $100 for emergencies for the year. I was going to be away a year, and they gave me $100 for emergencies. Really flush. Anyway, I went into a record sheet music store and bought... No, first I went into a used clothing store, which is something I thought I would drop dead if I ever did. And I bought a torn jacket and jeans and shoes, and I took my little Canadian pumps and the dress with the white Peter Pan collar and put it in the trash. And with the change, I went to a sheet music store and bought all the Bob Dylan songs, all the sheet music. So that's him and Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Yeah.
And for the whole year in Israel, everybody in the group I was in asked me to play a Molly song, sing a Molly song. So I thought I was good. I really thought I was good. Then that somebody in the group lived in Southern California in a town called Encino, which is part of L.A., and she invited me to come stay with her and her family if I ever wanted to visit California. So I did, and I stayed. And the reason I was able to stay is there were some questions on the visa I had to obtain. Was I an artist of exceptional merit? Absolutely. Was I doing a job that no American could do? Absolutely. I mean, who could sing and play the ukulele? I mean, and then the corker, though, was either of my parents an American citizen, and yes. So I got in, and I've been writing songs ever since.
I love, love, love this story. You know, one of the things I like the best is how children are born. And, you know, I'd asked you the question about an inner imperative. And your story is such an illustration of that because, you know, children, no matter what the parents necessarily want or desire the child to be, you know, so many children are born with this inner sense of who they already are. And that's what... You know, either that can be completely discouraged or, you know, it just continues through their life, no matter what, you know, their parents might have said. And that's a wonderful example in your case of that happening.
Well, thank you. My mother didn't have any plans for me except to be a wife, to marry rich Jewish dentist.
Well, that was kind of the times, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
That was kind of the times, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that was the times for sure. I don't know what Carol King's mother did, but after a while, she must have come around.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's so funny. I was lucky in that my father recognized my intellectual potential and encouraged me from a very young age, not in music or any of that, but definitely in using my brains. Now, let's talk then about how you first got into the music industry.
I was at the University of Toronto, and nearby there were two streets, Cumberland, and I'll think of the other one in a minute. And both of them were lined with coffee houses. One of them was called the Riverboat, and I had heard this girl singer on the radio, and I liked her song very much, and I got everybody from the dorm to come with me. Well, not everybody in the dorm, but everybody on our floor to come with me to the Riverboat. And we watched this girl singer. We were all singing along, and we went backstage to see her. And, I mean, I was 18 years old. What did I know? So this girl singer says to me, you know, I'm really discouraged because the Toronto Star gave me a terrible review. And I said, well, I think you should stick with it. Just keep going. And her name was Joni Mitchell.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, I'm sure I made no difference whatsoever to her, but I understood at that point that there were people who did things and people who criticized what people did, who had no idea what they were talking about. And when I finally arrived in L.A. several years later, I had a day job as a social worker for L.A. County Department of Public Social Services. And I wasn't much of a social worker, mostly because I had my phone off the hook. I mean, I couldn't deal with that stuff. So especially when I was writing songs, and parts of the part of the job that I love best is when I could sign out and say I was going to see a client for a home call, and in fact, I was really going to see the publishers, and I would go home, put on my little mini dress and my boots and my eyelashes, get my ukulele, and just go up and down Sunset Boulevard playing my ukulele for these music publishers. And they thought I was the Gong Show, but I was dead serious. So that's a very long answer to your question.
No, I love that. And I love the chutzpah that you had, that, you know, to take your ukulele and to go to those music publishers and play for them. And so these were original songs that you were playing. You then became, and I think there was somewhere in there a shift from writing the ukulele songs and both the music and lyrics into concentrating on lyrics. And you ended up as a staff songwriter with a couple major companies. So how hard was it to break in? How did that all happen? And was it even harder as a woman?
Well, the first part of the answer is the way I broke in was because every Friday afternoon at Warner Brothers on Hollywood Boulevard, there was a songwriter meeting, and anybody who wanted to could attend. It wasn't just for the staff writers at Warner Brothers. And there was a guy there named Artie Wayne. And Artie was the champion. He'd come up from nothing. He was black in a music business that at that time was basically white, other than Motown. So he was really a champion of great songwriters and hooks. And the hook is the part of the song that you can't help but sing. Anyway, every week I'd show up, there would be a blackboard full of names of artists who were looking for songs and what kind of song they wanted. So every week I'd show up, every week he'd critique my song. No, not there yet. No, not there yet. And all my colleagues, all the ladies I came up with, were getting deals at music publishing companies. And I thought, no way, I'm still at the welfare office. This is not it. So at one meeting, I went up to Artie and said, and I held my breath. I said, Artie, I have turned down several staff writing deals so I could continue working with you. And he says, really? Well, then sign with me. I mean, if I could have written it, I couldn't have written it any better. If he had said, so what, that would have been it.
Yeah.
So
now,
that was
you,
it.
I, Yeah, I just sorry to interrupt. Were you bluffing, or did you actually have some deal?
No.
And were you using? Ha! I love it.
I made it all up.
I made it all up. Oh.
Except
good
for the
for
part
you.
Of all my
that.
Friends were getting deals. That was true. So he had moved to A&M, and I was Paul Williams had just left A&M, so they needed somebody to write mostly lyrics. And no, it wasn't hard for me being a woman in those days because women were allowed to write lyrics. It was cute. You could have a hobby as a lyricist. It was fine. Most women, however, were groupies, and they really weren't quite sure what to do with me because I wasn't a groupie. And it just didn't ever occur to me that you wouldn't have any life of your own or dreams or goals of your own. That you were just following around some bass player. I mean, what is that? So I do have some stories about guys who hit on me and were inappropriate, but I'm not sure that's part of this conversation.
No, probably not. But boy, it's interesting in the light of everything that's happening right now. That probably could be another entire conversation. But yes, I know. I think there's not a woman around who doesn't have a story to tell in whatever industry she may have been in, and certainly in the male-dominated industries. But
well, you know this. But, I'll just mention one thing, and that this director Brett Ratner. Well, his uncle, producer of sorts in L.A. At the time, I was making the rounds of publishing companies. And his uncle, Norman, who was from the Jewish Home for the Short, used to rub himself against me and say, boy, I'd really love to record one of your songs. He never did record one of my songs. But when I saw that Brett had been fired, and I saw the surname, I said, well, it has to be his nephew. There has to be a family connection here.
Right. Oh, boy. just amazing. So here you are. You're a staff writer. You know, what was the process of being a staff writer? So you were hired, I assume, strictly to write lyrics, and you were then supposed to work with composers who were also staff writers. How did the whole process work?
Well, that same billboard they had on Hollywood Boulevard moved to Artie's office, and all the singers who were looking for songs were listed, and again, the kind of song they wanted was listed. At one point, Richard Carpenter, who was looking for songs for Karen, would even be so specific as to say, I want an oo sound at the end of this line, I want an E sound at the end of that line, and an ah sound at the end of that one. So these assignments could get very specific, and Barbra Streisand was cutting an album about water, and everything on the album had to do with water. So those assignments really got juicy. Anyway, so I was paired up with all the musicians at it's actually ALMO, which was the ASCAP name for the A&M Music Publishing Company. The BMI name was Irving. Anyway, so I was put together with the composers on staff there. I also worked with composers who were not on staff there. And it was really an exciting time because all I wanted in the world was a hit song, and there were a lot of people telling me no. I remember calling one guy, and this was after I'd had several hits, and I said, I've just listened to your new album, and I'd love to write some songs with you. And he said, why would I want to write with you? So that I got a lot of that. I don't think that had anything to do with being female, though. I think it was just his ego that he'd have more hits than I had. So the process was to write the song and hope it fit somebody. And it turned out that if it didn't fit that person, down the line it fits somebody else.
So how did the first hit come around for you?
The first hit. Well, back in the days when we were on Hollywood Boulevard at the Friday meeting, I wrote a song called Silver Wings and Golden Rings with a guy who also went to the meetings. And Warner Brothers wanted the song, and so they published it, and they gave us $150 for the publishing rights for 1 year. And I said, well, that's very nice, but I need a clause. I don't know where I got this, but I said, I need a clause saying if you don't record it in a year, I get the song back. Oh, we don't do that here, dear. I said, well, I do. Okay, so we got the, and they pitched the heck out of the song, and it was never a hit. Okay, years up, I call Ed Silvers, who's the president of Warner Brothers Music, and I said, Ed, do you want to keep my song? Oh, yeah, we're going to keep it. We're going to keep pitching. I said, fine. Well, could you please messenger over a check for $150? Oh, Molly Ann, we're not going to throw good money after bad. And I said, well, then I'm sorry, but I would like to have the song back. Well, we don't do that. I said, yes, you do. Look at paragraph J. Okay, so I get the song back, and a few years later, I'm in a writing meeting, and I hauled out that. Meanwhile, my writing partner got his melody. I kept the lyric. A few years later, I'm in a writing meeting, and we write a new song called Silver Wings and Golden Rings. And at the time, Kim Carnes made all our demos for $25. And a brilliant keyboard arranger, keyboardist arranger named Bill Como played keyboard on all our demos. And they were all just piano voice. Anyway, we made a heck of a demo, and a big country singer named Billy Joe Spears cut the song, and it was number one. And, I mean, you couldn't talk to me. You couldn't talk to me. I was driving down Sunset Boulevard in the rain with my sunroof open, and I was standing up screaming the song. That's my song! And, you know, Hollywood, they don't pay any attention. They think everybody's nuts there. But that was the time. Let me tell you.
Oh.
Silver Wings and Golden Rings, and I got to go to the ASCAP Country Music Awards in Nashville. Oh, my God. And I'm looking at a picture right now of Ed Shea and Stanley Adams giving me my plaque, my very first plaque.
Oh, that's such a wonderful story. I love the standing up and yelling on Hollywood Boulevard in the rain. I mean, I'm the filmmaker part of me is like seeing that as
yeah.
a film. It's so great. And, you know, I was curious when you said you wrote another song with the same title. Does that mean that you actually wrote a brand new song, different lyrics, different music?
It was. Pretty much the same story, but the lyric was quite a bit different.
And the melody had changed or not?
Oh, the melody was completely different.
Oh, that's very interesting.
In fact, I don't even remember the first melody.
What's interesting about it is that you took something that had gone, you know, whatever distance it had gone, but wasn't far enough for you, and you revamped it and you made it a hit. And that's a lesson to all of those who are creative people to know that you can often take material and, you know, learn ways to use it that improve it and turn it into something wonderful.
It also shows you, and I'm not just talking about songs, but whether you write a book or you write a screenplay or whatever, it can have its time long after you create it. So save it. Save it. Keep good files. Anyway, the end of the story is even better. My song was called Silver Wings and Golden Rings, And remember, the publisher who didn't want to keep it was named Ed Silvers. And
yes,
we were both at the ASCAP Country Awards banquet. And since he was Silvers and I was Silver Wings, we were seated next to each other. And he told me, he said, "Molly, I should never have given you your song back." So he was very gracious.
Oh,
so I don't know whatever happened to Ed, but I don't think my hit song was the end of his career.
No. But that is a great story, and great that he acknowledged that as well.
Yeah.
Now, describe a couple of your experiences. I mean, you have won some major awards, like the Oscar, for example, or a platinum record more than one. I mean, these are, again, just so, so incredible. And so tell me a little bit about, I mean, obviously after that hit song, you continue to write songs that are being covered by all these major, major performers. And so tell me a little bit about an experience of winning one of those top awards.
Well, getting a gold record or a platinum record is very exciting. You watch the charts. You call every Wednesday, "How's my song doing?" Cross yourself as you make the call. And, "Oh, my God, it's up two more. Oh, my God. Oh, my God, it's number one. Oh, my God. Oh, my God." And you live for Wednesday. And and then you finally get gold, and, "Oh, my God," then it's platinum. But it's after that, it's anticlimactic because the record shows up months later. And it's not even your song. They take some CD, some album that doesn't even sell, and they slap silver or gold paint on it. And they put your name on it with a picture of the album, and there it is.
Right.
As for the other stuff, it's very exciting. But I think the best part of the whole thing with Violet was I never had a relationship with my family. I'm talking we were the original dysfunctional Jewish-Canadian family. I think we are the textbook what not to do. But anyhow, the night that Violet won an Oscar, my father actually called me. And I couldn't believe it, and he started to cry.
Oh,
so that was a moment that was worth 100 years alone.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And it's that, you know, that realization that, one, you showed your parents you could do it, and two, that your parent recognized that you could do it.
Well, so for whatever. But when you talk about drive, the truth is a lot of parents of people in the industry champion them. My son, the songwriter, David Pomerantz is a wonderful songwriter. He wrote a couple of hits that were big for Barry Manilow, "Trying to Get the Feeling Again." And I'll think of the other one in a minute. But I met his father one night at a club at the Roxy in Hollywood, and he just was beaming, thinking that his son was getting to be an artist. Mr. Pomerantz apparently was in the brassiere business, which is a long ways from being in the music business, but he championed his son, and gosh, I guess it must skip a generation for Canadians. But I never had a fallback position. So if I didn't make it as a songwriter, there was no other option. I wasn't married. I wasn't going with anybody I wanted to marry. The only thing I could think of was writing songs. I had to be successful. Failure was not an option.
And I think that put you in the position of, you know, of committing to your path that much more strongly because it was a have to. It wasn't an option.
I agree.
Yeah. Now, when did you realize that you were also good at coaching and helping other songwriters? And how did you get that going? Because that's really now your entrepreneurial business nature coming through.
There was a songwriting class at UCLA called the Songwriters Workshop. And the person who had been teaching the class didn't want to teach anymore, and she told me to call UCLA Extension and go have an interview, which I did. And I said, gosh, I'm so nervous. She says, don't. You've got the job going in. So it was a great time. I met some fantastic songwriters. One of them is from Manhattan Transfer. And we're now Facebook friends. And I'm so proud of her. I could, well, I don't want to use the real word, burp, I guess would be appropriate.
Yes.
But I mean, I had all kinds of students there. A lot of them have won Grammys, been nominated for Grammys, very talented people. And I used the outline for my class as the basis for my first book, How to Write a Hit Song. So it all kind of worked together. And then after the semester was over, the students of my class would say, well, can I have a private session with you? A private session. Okay. And well, in between my gigs as a staff writer, there was always some lag time, so I didn't have any income to speak of. And so this really very nicely filled in the gaps. I lived in a cute little guest house on 4th Street in Santa Monica, and every Sunday afternoon at 2, the most talented songwriters in the world would walk into my house. And we'd sit there and have a salon, and people would play, and we would critique the songs, and they'd come back the next week with the songs much improved. And we had wonderful meetings together. So when I realized, hey, you know, these people are asking me, can I have a private session? And so I thought, well, hey, this is extra income. I was saving for a house. And it was fun. So then it just sort of never went away. I suddenly had a book and a consulting business, and then there was the internet. It it used to be before the internet, if somebody bought my book, it was pretty well a given that they would contact me and become a client. And it was unusual for people to have clients that didn't have to be in the same office or room with you. So we did things on the phone.
And now the internet, I know it just makes a huge difference. And I totally understand. I fell into coaching writers in pretty much the same way that you describe. Now, you stretched once again, you know, and of course you had gone into writing these nonfiction books, which you just talked about, which is one more stretch. But then you stretched once again when you began writing speeches. How did that come about?
I have a dear friend I grew up with named Fran Yeagod. She's in Montreal. And a few years ago, well, it was way more than a few years ago, she called me up and said, she was being installed as the president of the auxiliary at the Montreal General Hospital, and she needed a really great speech. She said, I can write a good one, but I need a great one. So would you help me? I said, Fran, I've never written a speech. Oh, you can do it. You can do it. So when do you need it? Tonight. Oh, well, I'm used to writing songs in a hurry. But anyway, I interviewed her. I wrote her speech, and she was thrilled. And then she asked me to write a couple more. And then friends of hers asked me to write a couple more. And then I decided I better have a website. And then people all over the country in Canada were calling me to write speeches for them, too. So, you know, it sounds almost like happenstance that I never went after being a songwriter. I never dreamed of being a songwriting consultant when I was a little girl. And the same thing with being a speechwriter. So it's remembering that if someone asks you, can you do this? You always say yes, mm-hmm. and then you go learn
yeah.
how to ride a horse.
You know, that's so funny because I've done a number of presentations about being a Wren woman, and one of the things that I say is having the can I roller skate attitude, which is when someone says, can you roller skate, whether you can or not, you always answer, can I roller skate? And then you learn. And that's, you know, you've just illustrated beautifully. And the other thing that I've noticed with Wren women is that they are open to learning something new. They're open to trying something, and then they discover that they have gifts that they didn't even know they had. And unless you're open to it, you don't discover that. So you're a walking, talking example of that.
Well, thank you. By the way, I've read your book, and it's these women, they're wonderful women. I would love to have a day with all of us having a picnic somewhere.
I know. I think that I would love to do that too. Bring them all in from the various places they live, because the women in the book are just fantastic. Now, we're starting to run a little low on time, so I want to make sure. I had a couple more questions. I always run out of time because it's such fun to have these interviews, but I do want to make sure to give you some time to tell our listeners about how they can find out more about you, your services, your books, you know, everything. Tell us how best to find those things out and to reach you.
Songwriters, singer-songwriters, and lyricists can reach me at my website, SongMD, S-O-N-G, M like Molly, D like Doctor, songmd.com. I have a huge website where I offer my services as a coach, as a consultant, putting lyricists together with composers, and helping my clients to market their finished songs. Mm-hmm. For exceptional submissions. Sometimes a client will send 10 songs and or 10 lyrics, and one of them is just unbelievably good or has one of those million-dollar titles.
Mm-hmm.
We decide to co-write. And I want people to understand that just because they send me something for consultation doesn't mean I'm going to co-write. But if I decide that I have the magic in me to turn what they send me into a hit song, then we can discuss co-writing. And I've been very lucky for my clients. 12 of them have Grammy nominations. 12 have Grammys. 15 have Grammy nominations. And so far, Dale, with my help, 7,470 as of this morning, other writers and artists have placed their work in movies, in TV shows, on CDs, in video games, commercials, and their tracks are downloaded all over the web.
Yes, yes.
So that's
so
songwriting. For speech writing, I am available at anythingwithwords.com. That's three words, anything with words all together, .com.
Mm-hmm.
And it has examples of the speeches I've written and the kinds of things that I like to do. And my 800 number, which works for both of my businesses, which is 800-851-6588. And remember, I'm on California time. So when it's 8 o'clock in New York, I'm still sound asleep.
Okay. Well, now we're going to say goodbye. We have only 30 seconds left of our show. So I want to thank you so much, Molly. This has been fascinating and just a wonderful time spent with you.
Well, thank you, Dale. It was fun for me, too. And thank you for writing this wonderful book, Wren Women.
Oh, appreciate it. I appreciate it. And Wren Women, by the way, is available at Amazon.com and can be ordered at a bookstore near you. Thank you so much. And come again, listeners. And you can always download this program later or stream it later. Thank you.